Okay, so continuing to a less sort of national story, the short unit at the end of Parshas Balosra, the story of Moshe and his Isha Kushit, his Kushite wife. So we got to try to figure out in the stories. First of all, who is this person? What is going on? What are Moshe and Aaron? What are Aaron and Miriam complaining about? What is this? Why does the story happen when it does? Which is something we've already sort of hinted at last week. So, but let's see. It's a short story, relatively. Okay. So, v'tadaber Miriam v'Aaron b'Moshe al odot ha'yisha ha'kushit asher lakach yisha kushit lakach. So Moshe and Miriam and Aaron spoke about Moshe, or against Moshe, really, because of the Kushite woman that he had married, for he had taken a Kushite woman. Vayamru harak ach b'Moshe diber Adonai, lo gam banu diber vayishma Adonai. And they said, did God only speak to Moshe? He spoke to us as well. Vayish Moshe anav me'od mikol adam asher al pnei adama. And Moshe was the most humble of people on earth. So right there, just the first three psukim, right, which is sort of the first mini unit in it, there are so many questions you have to ask, right? First of all is, who is the Isha Kushit? Mm-hmm. Second one is, what does it mean, Asher Lakach? When did he take her? Right? When did he marry her? Now, either we're going to say he married her now, in which case you have to ask, where did she come from? Right? Like, you are in the middle of the desert. Where is he? You know, he suddenly got married to whoever this is. Who is she? Where is she from? How'd she get here? If, on the other hand, you say, no, he didn't marry her now, then why are they complaining about it now? The next pasuk is equally weird. You've got to ask, okay, whatever it is, he married this woman, so I don't know, they didn't like her, you know, what is the fact that God, that they are prophets as well as Moshe, have anything to do with the wife that he took? Right? There doesn't seem to be any direct corollary, and this is why the commentaries struggle. And then the third pasuk has nothing to do with anything, seemingly, which is Moshe was the most humble of men. That, what is that going to explain? So then, that's the first mini unit. Then the story picks up. Vayomer Adonai pitom el Moshe ve'al Aaron ve'al Miriam su shlozachem el moed v'yatsu v'yitsu shloshtam. So suddenly God speaks to Moshe, Aaron, and Miriam and says, go out, all three of you, from the old moed, and they go out. Vayir Adonai b'amud anan. So God's presence descended, goes to the Oel, and he calls specifically Aaron and Miriam. Now he singles them out, and they go out. And they say, most prophets, I appear to them in a dream. But not my servant Moshe. In all my houses he is trustworthy. I speak to Moshe mouth to mouth, in a vision and not in riddles. He sees a picture of God, whatever that means. How are you not afraid to speak about my servant Moshe? And God is angry and he leaves. Now, here you have another oddity, because if I just ask you in the first three psukim, before they get punished, even if you have an intuition that Aaron and Miriam did something wrong, what did they do that was wrong? They spoke Lashon Hara about the Isha Kushit. God elides that point. He doesn't talk about the Isha Kushit. He said, why weren't you afraid to talk about Moshe? He's a great prophet. So we didn't understand what prophecy had to do with Moshe and Aaron originally, right? Their claim originally. But it seems like that wasn't accidental, because the only thing God cares about, it has nothing to do with the Isha Kushit. Right? Maybe he does, but in Pshat, he doesn't. Right? The Psukim don't even explain what happened. And then God leaves. V'hanan sarme aloel. And then the presence of God in the cloud leaves, and Miriam has sara'at, and her skin is white as snow, and Aaron turns to Miriam, and whoa, she has sara'at, she has leprosy. This is always the problem. I complained to this before, it's Friday, there's nothing you can do about it, right? It has an automatic replace for all Shem Hashem. The problem is, sometimes it's, in this case, it's not Kodesh. They're talking to Moshe, Adoni, right? My master Moshe, but it doesn't matter because it just automatically corrects it. But okay, Vayomer Aaron el Moshe, be Adoni, please don't consider this a sin against us. We were foolish. We made a mistake. Let Miriam not be like a dead person who comes out of the mother's womb with half its flesh eaten. Or right, people don't really understand this passage, but seemingly what he's saying is, let her not look like a stillborn. Right, meaning someone who was born dead. Right, that's the imagery. Right, that comes out of the womb. Right, with the skin already half devoured. Meaning someone who, right, I don't know if stillborns are particularly pale. I'm not quite sure, but that's clearly the imagery that he is invoking of a stillborn, or a baby who's dying in birth or something like that. Right, sort of a particularly visceral image. Vayitzak Moshe Adonai Lemor Elna Refan Allah. So then Moshe offers the shortest prayer in Chumash and says, please, God, heal her, please. And God says to Moshe, if her father spit in her face, would she not be locked up for 7 days? She should at least be, you know, put away for 7 days, and then she can come home. Now we have another question here. Is okay, Aaron asks Moshe to pray for Miriam, and Moshe does. Does God answer his prayer or not? Not clear, because it's not clear what the original plan was. Right? Was the original plan that she would be kicked out for 7 days, and therefore God is saying no? Right? Moshe was saying heal her immediately, and God said no, it's a week. Or was the original plan that this was it, Miriam was kicked out forever, and Moshe and God said yes, but not immediately? Right? It's not clear. What was the original plan? How far? We don't know. But so she is kicked out for 7 days, and they travel only she comes back. And then they travel to Midbar Paran. So you see that just in these few psukim, right, there are so many questions we have to ask just on what's going on in the story. Why is it here? Okay, so let's go question by question. First question: Rashi is going to try to answer several of these questions at once. Rashi is going to try to answer the question of who is Isha Kushit? What does it mean, Asher Lakach? Right? To keep in mind, again, all the questions we have to answer as we go through the story, and why it happens now. He's going to try to answer all three at once.
And why there's a couple times repeat itself. Like, why Ki Isha Kushit Lakach? And just to call us that. And the same thing with Mitzorah. It also repeats it.
Right. So it could be that it's for emphasis, right? Or it could be... and we'll see in some of the Mepharshim that it's past tense, right? Right, ki shaluki shilakach, right? Is that the Lashon Hara happened now, but the marriage didn't, right? That it's, right? Now Rashi, which is what, well, that's what Rashi's going to say, right? I mean, Rashi is going to have a past oriented. He's going to say, ki shilakach means
he had taken,
and then Rashi needs to explain, well, okay, if this is a past event, then why are we only hearing about it now, right? So that's the key shalukit lakach, is why is this happening? Well, it happened in the past, and then you have to, it begs the question, why now? So Rashi's going to try to answer all of those, or its emphasis, but we'll see that most of the Mepharshim will think it's a past tense. So Rashi says as follows, he patcha b'dibor t'chila, l'fichach hikdima katuv t'chila. Okay, so first of all, Miriam gets punished. The pasuk starts with Miriam because she started the Lashon Hara. Fine. Minayin ata yodat Miriam shepirash Moshe ben Aisha. Rashi tells you that he's going to say that she is, that the Isha Kushit is Tzipora, and he's going to say that Isha Kushit Lakach means that he married her, and this isn't in the text, and separated from her. Right? Meaning he has to interpolate words. So according to Rashi, it means Moshe and Aaron criticize... Well, you know, let me give it away first, and then we'll go through Rashi, right? This is going to be Rashi's interpretation of the story. Isha Kushit is Tzipora. Moshe has one wife. Moshe, since Har Sinai, because he's a prophet who talks to God all the time, is separate from his wife so that he's always pure. So then the question is, okay, first of all, why does the pasuk say kishashu kushit lakach if the real problem is not lakach but azav? Right? Isn't the marriage? It's the fact that he's separated from her. So Rashi says, well, you just have to, presumably you just have to interpolate that, right? Meaning, it's about the wife that he had married, dot, 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 and he had separated from, it's not in the text. So then Rashi says, okay, well, why did they complain now? Because they only knew now. Because, as we'll see, Rashi says that Eldad and Medad's wives said, oyvei. Sorry, Eldad and Medad became prophets, and Tzipora said to Miriam, oyvei, right? Now they're not going to have family life. And Miriam said, what? Right? And she said, yeah, my husband hasn't been with me since, you know, Harsinai. And then the next pasuk, why do Miriam and Aaron complain and say, we are prophets too? Because Tzipora had complained that because her husband's a prophet, they don't live together. And Miriam said, well, since when does being a prophet mean that you can't live together with your spouse? We're prophets, and we do. Why do we hear about the story now, even though it happened in the past? Ki isha kushit lakach, because she only found out about it now. So ki isha kushit lakach indicates that the story really happened a long time ago. But the reason Miriam ends up complaining about it is because she finds out about it now, and that's why you have the ki isha kushit lakach, because it's emphasizing that the marriage itself is past tense. It's only the lashon hara, which is current, and it's. And why is this story here? Because of Eldad and Medad, right? This is Rashi. So read inside. He says, "Okay, minayin hatayodat Miriam sheperesh Moshe minisha? How did Miriam know that Moshe had separated from Tzipora? Rabbi Natan Omer Miriam hayta b'tzad Tzipora b'sha shamar l'Moshe Eldad and Medad mitnabim b'machane. Miriam was next to Tzipora when Moshe found out that Eldad and Medad were prophesying. Kevan sheshamat Tzipora, and when Tzipora heard." Amra oilin shoten shalelu, and she said, "Woe to the wives of Eldad and Medad imhem niska kim lenuvuashu proshim minishotehem, because now that they are prophets, they are going to separate from their wives. Kedach shapeirish baali mimeni, like my husband is separated from me. Misham yadam Miriam, and that's how Miriam knew. Vihigidil Aaron, then she tells Aaron, Uma Miriam shall nit kavel gnuto kach nensha, and if." Miriam, who didn't mean to make fun of Moshe, she just, you know, she thought it was a problem, and she was punished anyways. So for sure, anybody else who degrades, disparages his friend. Why is she called Aisha Kushit? So he said, meaning she was as obviously beautiful as someone who's black is black. And that's how Rashi understands the word Kushit. Okay. Now, according to Rashi, we can now go back and solve all the problems, right? Rashi says, why, if it's about Kisha Kushit Lakach, why does the Pasuk emphasize prophecy both in their critique and in the response? Because that's really what's at stake here, is that Miriam and Aaron are complaining that Moshe is, because he's a prophet, not being with his wife. Aren't we prophets also? And Hashem answers, no, you're not. Right? Not the same way he's a prophet. Right? He's a greater prophet. The Ibn Ezra also, just as a technical point, also believes that Tzipora is Miriam. The Isha Kushit is Tzipora. How does he understand the word? He just has a much, what I think is a simpler pshat-oriented thing, which is Kushi doesn't necessarily mean black, it means dark-skinned. And people from the Middle East are dark-skinned. People who hang out outside are darker-skinned, right? Kishah Kushit means just to the exclusion of being fair, and people who grew up outside in the Middle East are darker-skinned than people who weren't outside in the Middle East, and therefore she was, right? She wasn't black, she wasn't Kushit, right? Like, from Ethiopia, she was Middle Eastern, right? And it's just, right, that's what he said. She was blacker, she was darker, that's all. Okay, that's a technical point, but he also agrees that is Tzipora. I just gave you in four, right? That how do you read Lakach? Right, so Al HaTorah just notes. Most of these commentators read the verse as if it is abbreviated with an understood ending. The Kushite woman who he had married and then separated from. Then what's the relationship between the complaints? So according to this approach, the statements of Miriam and Aaron in verse 1 and 2 are integrally connected. The siblings assert their prophetic status to prove that such a role does not require abstinence, and thus that Moshe's prophesying cannot justify his treatment of the wife. Right? That's their story. Now, the bigger question there for Rashi is, okay, I mean, you could ignore this question and say, well, why is this story here? Right? Because according to Rashi, the answer might just be the story is here because it's here. It is. Right? It happened now, so it's put here. But the truth is that, as we saw, the Eldon made the story, when there are new prophets, right, emphasize that there's a challenge to Moshe's leadership because now there are other prophets around. This story also sort of makes sense to happen here because it's not just that Moshe and Aaron happened to find out that Moshe is separated from his wife. It's also the time when the question everyone's going to be thinking, what does it mean to be a prophet? Are there different levels of prophets? Now that Moshe isn't alone, right, there are 70 other prophets that he's called in, is Moshe unique? And this story also emphasizes the fact that, yes, there are other prophets, but those prophets aren't Moshe. And this story, right, especially as Rashi understands it, is pointing specifically to Eldad and Medad and saying, them, are they like Moshe? And Tzipora is saying, oh, they're just like Moshe. And Hashem's answer to both Tzipora, Miriam, and Aaron is, no, not quite. So the story also serves an integral purpose, which is to highlight that just because in the last unit, other people entered into Moshe's sphere as leaders, that doesn't mean that Moshe isn't unique. He still is. But on the other hand, that's not something that's obvious. It's something that was suddenly called into question by the episode of Eldad and Medad. And therefore, God has to go out of his way to assert this. Now, Rashi doesn't weigh in on sort of the theoretical, the broader issue in terms of Moshe's humility. What does Moshe's humility have to do with it? Right? Rashi just says on his anava. Does it say anything? I don't think it actually says. And yeah, no. Rashi doesn't even weigh in on why it says that he's anav. It just says that he is. But according to Rashi, we can suggest, why does it matter that he's anav? Because Moshe, it's clear, never articulated his uniqueness, right? For the first time, Moshe's uniqueness is being challenged. Why is it being challenged? Because he never articulated that he was different. But now that it's actually being called into question, not just by Miriam and Aaron, but by Eldad and Medad and the other 70 people, suddenly God has to step in and say, you weren't going to explain why you're different, but I will, right? Alternatively, his anava is mentioned to explain why he is so amenable to forgiving his sister, because he doesn't care about his own honor, right? So the story is either here to explain why Moshe never explained how he was a unique prophet, or to explain why he's so easily appeased, because he doesn't care that his siblings didn't realize that he was unique. God cares, but Moshe himself doesn't care. Okay. That's possibility one.
Oh. Sorry, that's my water. I'm so sorry. Just continue.
Okay, so that's possibility one. Possibility two is radically different. Radically different, come on. Why not? Which is, so, the right possibility two is to say that Isha Kushit is not Tzipora. Now, who, then, is this woman? So, there are two questions that are interrelated here that lead to very, very, I don't know how to explain this, wild interpretations, which I didn't even include all of it. I didn't include every detail of it. But one question that this second group of Mefarshim want to answer is, who is the Isha Kushit, if not Tzipora? The second question is, where was Moshe from the time he... This was last week's parsha. I gave the corollary, and I can give it next week, or I can just summarize it here. The second question... Yeah, is where was Moshe for 40 years, 60 years, however many years? Right? The Torah tells you that Moshe goes out to his brothers when he's a young man. So how old is he? The Midrash says maybe he's 20, maybe he's 40, however old he is. Right? But let's say he's like 20. He goes out, sees his brothers, kills the Mitzri. Paro gets angry, he flees to Midian. You read the Psukim, it sounds like he flees to Midian. He ends up that night at Yitro's house, meets Tzipora, a shidduch is made, they get married, and then, when he gets in Parsha Vayera, last week's Parsha, when he comes to Paro, the Torah tells you he's 80. The problem is that Moshe had, according to the simple read of the Pasuk, had a baby right before he came back to Mitzrayim, because Tzipora gave a bris milah to that baby on the way to Mitzrayim. So, what you would, right, the problem is, if you read the story that way, that means, let's say Moshe got married as soon as he got to Midian, and then was what, infertile, they didn't have children for 58 years or something, right? And then, okay, maybe they got married a year or two in, for 50 some odd years, and then he has a little baby, and the Torah doesn't bother telling us that it's a miracle that Moshe is 80 years old when he's fathering a child, right? This is like Avram level miracles. The Torah just like glides over this. So many different approaches we're giving to it, but there's a strong tradition, a old tradition that appears everywhere, just everywhere. It appears in Jewish sources in a weird midrash called Midrash Toldot Moshe Rabbeinu. But also it appears in Josephus in one version, it appears in Eusebius, who's one of the church fathers, in another version. It appears in like in all of the Apocrypha, like every Jewish source from the ancient world, rabbinic, not rabbinic, everybody, that Moshe had a period where he was king in Ethiopia. This is their solution, is that Moshe didn't go straight to Midian. The Torah doesn't tell you. But Moshe went from Egypt to Ethiopia. This is the version of Eusebius. And he became king in Ethiopia, and he married a Cushite woman, right, an Ethiopian woman. And then eventually makes it to Midian, and he marries again, right? And either his wife came with him, or his wife had gone back to Ethiopia. Now she joins them. You know, she comes with her entourage, her royal entourage, or whatever. In Josephus, he has this long, long story that Moshe was the Egyptian prince, and he led an army against Ethiopia. And while he was fighting Ethiopia, the Ethiopian princess fell in love with him, even though he was an Egyptian. So he ended up marrying this Ethiopian princess, and she came back with him to Egypt. Right? Like, all types of versions of this story. The Rashbam thinks that this is the solution to this story. And he writes, right, this is the last source on the page, Ishakushit Lakach, Kedichtiv Divrei Yamim, as it says in Divrei Yamim, this midrash of Midrash Divrei Yamim Lamoshe. The Moshe Rabbeinu Melech Hayav Eretz Kush 40 Shana. He was a king in Ethiopia for 40 years. Lakach Malka Achat, and he took a queen. Velo Shachav Imak Mashkel Shami. He never was with her. He was never intimate with her. Vehem Lo Yaduk Shadru Vol Shlon Iskaklav Zekur Ze Ikar Pshuto. So this is the reason I gave the show last week was I challenged people. I said, what is Pshat? Right? The Rashbam is the consummate Pashtan, right? He only cares about the simple read of the text. And here he's buying into a whole story that doesn't appear in the text. The reason is because pshat means what's the simplest understanding of the story. And sometimes the simplest understanding of the story is that things happen that you didn't hear about. You know, there's, because otherwise you come to phenomenally weird conclusions, like Rav Pinchas of Kuritz, one of the Hasidic Rebbes, who wrote that the Avot, like anybody in Torah, the only words they said in their lives are the ones found in Chumash. Otherwise they were silent. Now, that's not pshat. I don't care if it didn't happen in the Torah. Pshat is that, yeah, you know, Avram woke up in the morning and said, good morning, right? Like, that is pshat, even though it's not in the Torah. So the Rashbam actually thinks that, you know, this is pshat. He had a different wife. Now, he also takes this notion that he never consummated that union, right, and still focuses on that. But he thinks that's the wife we're talking about. Not Tzipora, it's his second wife. And again, they're complaining that he never consummated that union, not the one with Tzipora, which he did, presumably, but not the one with that queen.
And where was she all this? He was with them, and now? Or
so you get different versions of this. I should have put the rest of the, I mean, sure I can look at what the Rashbam says in the end. But the right, you have some versions that she, you know, she was with him. Right, like, you know, from, and some that she, you know, come to me. You have all types of versions of this. You know, again, it could be, you know, you can mix and match. There are all types of academic articles. Literally, go through every tradition of this Ethiopian woman. When she married him, and you know, was he king? Was he general? Was he this? Was he that? You know, like it's the Rashbam's. Yeah, one second. Yeah, but I'm getting it. The Shadal, right? Shadal takes a also thinks it's a Cushite woman, but he doesn't think it's the Cushite princess. And he says as follows: he says that actually this was a Cushite woman he married now. Where did she come from? Right? I mean, he just wants to read Isha Kushit Lakach as, for she had married a Cushite woman now. So he said, oh, where did a Cushite woman come from there in the middle of the desert? He said, no, it wasn't someone who came now. When we'll read it in a second, he said, there were Ethiopians living in Mitzrayim, right? They're adjacent countries. And they were there when they saw the miracles and they converted. This wasn't a, right? This wasn't someone who'd come from Cush now. It was meaning someone who had originally come from Cush and had joined the Jewish people as a convert or whatever, or maybe not as a convert or whatever, had joined the Jewish people when they left Mitzrayim. Right? That's what he says. And why did Moshe and Aaron and Miriam complain? So he takes a totally different approach. He thinks it was arrogance that Moshe felt, you know, oh, the Jews, I'm too good. They thought that Moshe thought that he was too good for the Jews and therefore he wanted to marry the exotic foreign woman. Right? And that's how they understand the story. And that's how he understands Ki Anav Me'od, right? That he was humble, is that the issue wasn't that, was really that they challenged his humility. Right? They thought that he was high in himself because he was a prophet and therefore he was marrying the exotic woman because, hey, I'm the coolest, I'm cool, right? I marry whatever. When in fact, no, that's not what happened, is he was, I don't know, right? That's how he takes it. But no, he was the most, I don't know, he just married her because he married her, right? She was, you know, he got married again, whatever, he did. That was what people did, right? He said, they thought it was arrogant that he didn't marry a Jew. They can't criticize him for Tzipora. Right, Israel. He married a Midianite because he had been fleeing. He wasn't in Israel. Aval Bamidbar, like Rameta, right? Either this was his second wife because Tzipora had died, or he married two wives. Not sure. Ein Safek Shemotzei Bat Yisrael Shenaselo. He could have married a Jew. Aval Pishas Zaken, even though he was old, right? He's the king. He can do whatever he wants. You know, kings marry even elderly. We know that, right? Powerful people. That's what happens. Then he goes, this is like weird psychology. He's like, maybe they were angry because they wanted their kids, right? His nieces and nephews to marry Moshe. They were, you know, like, you know, European monarchy style. You just marry your nieces, nephews, cousins, whatever. It stays in the family. He married one of those Ethiopians who had joined the Jews in Egypt. Because Ethiopia and Mitzrayim are next to each other. And they had been living maybe in Mitzrayim, and they'd seen what God did for the Jews, and therefore, you know, they'd been a part of it. So this is, you know, completely different from Rashi, meaning he thinks that the complaint isn't about the separating, the complaint is about the marriage itself. And they don't think that it's a past one, he thinks it's a current marriage. And he thinks that the main critique isn't about the prophecy, right? Or the nature of his prophecy, it's actually about his arrogance, right? That's the main part of it. They thought that he became arrogant because of his prophecy, and God has to come and say, no, 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 my dear Moshe is humble. Is humble, right?
Humble as they come.
Right. Ibn Kaspi, I didn't give it to you because it's like very long and it's really weird, but Ibn Kaspi has a even weirder Dion here, and he understands as follows. He also thinks it was a second wife, which he married now. But he thinks it is about prophecy, and like this. They were upset because he engaged in polygamy. And they thought that they could challenge him because they were prophets, which is why God had to say, no, he's a greater prophet. And God said to them, look, he's a greater prophet, and therefore he can have more than one wife. You know why? Because he says, "Hagadol mechaveru, yitzro gadol mimenu." Anyone who's greater has a bigger yetzer hara. How do I know? David was great, and look how many times he failed, and look how many wives he had at 18. And then he says, Avram was great, that's why he had two or three wives. Yaakov was great, that's why he had four wives. So if Moshe is great, he needs at least two, and they didn't get it because they weren't as great prophets as him. It's like this very weird thing. But then he tells you at the end, he said, not like the Christians, right? He said, not like the Christians. This is clearly an anti-Christian polemic. Now, and I put this at the end, but I'll say it now. What's fascinating, now this doesn't cut to the heart of the story. It's really hard up. But Rav Bazak points out that the irony here is that the pshat, right, if you take like a Ibn Kaspi approach, that he married a second wife and they're complaining about second wife, is that God is affirming that being a prophet doesn't require abstinence, right, and separation from the world. And according to Ibn Kaspi, actually might encourage you to be engaged in the world even more, so to speak. The Midrash that Rashi quotes encourages the idea that the greatest prophets should be abstinent. Everybody who isn't the greatest doesn't have to, but if you're the greatest of the great, you would, which are two opposite approaches, right? Is the lesson of the story that even Moshe Rabbeinu can be married either for a second time or even have two wives, right? That even in his old age, it's legitimate for him to be married the way Shaddai takes it, right? Be married a second time. That it's not weird for him to want to be married at every stage in his life, right? Or according to Ibn Kaspi, it's not weird for him to want two wives because we don't believe in abstinence for anybody ever. Or is the message of the story that at a certain level you're great enough that you should be, you know, celibate and off from the world, right? Those are two radically different approaches that emerge from Rashi and Ibn Kaspi, or even Shaddai at some level. Okay, now Rashbam, let me just see. Does he explain why here, or does he just not? No, that's why I didn't put it. No, he doesn't explain. He doesn't explain whether it was just now, why they're complaining now. Okay. Now, so why, but why are they complaining now? So again, Ibn Kaspi, Shaddai, because it happened now. Rashi, because they found out now. The Ran, I think, has the most fascinating one. And now this comes back. Now that we've sort of set down the details of the story, now to the bigger question, why does it happen now? So again, according to Ibn Kaspi, it just happens now. According to Rashi, they found out now, but we noted that it cuts to the theme of the text. But the Ran tells you explicitly that the reason the story happens now is not because they got married now, nor because he separated now, but because of the previous story. And the Ran says as follows. It is about separation, like Rashi. But you know why it happened now? Because until now, Moshe wasn't with his wife. But Aaron Miriam said, well, that makes sense. He's running a whole nation by himself. He literally doesn't have time to go home. He's at the office, right, till 2 in the morning every day. And if he doesn't, the nation will collapse. Right? But hey, he just appointed a bureaucracy. He should have time. He has underlings. Go home. Take a vacation. Right? There are other people who can do your work. You don't need to micromanage. And then they saw that Moshe was still in the office till 2 in the morning. And they said, wait a second, you appointed a bureaucracy, you appointed other leaders, and you still think you got to do everything yourself? You're not that, well, if you were doing everything yourself, fine, but you're not anymore. So the Ran tells you, why is this story here? Not just because it happened now, because as we discussed last week, appointing the 70 other leaders substantively changed the nature of Moshe's leadership. And therefore, Miriam and Aaron start to say, well, how radically did this change it, right? Do you need to be in charge anymore in such an involved way? And the answer is, right now, if we sort of take the Ran to the next step, the answer is, even though he has other leaders, Moshe still is that important. He's still that involved, right? And that's why this story is here, because Miriam and Aaron, right, there's a misconception you could have from last week's story, right? That now Moshe is less the leader because there are other people. And God retorts, no, no, he's still unique. There may be other people involved, but Moshe's leadership is still necessary, and therefore nothing has changed from yesterday to today. There are more leaders, but Moshe is still Moshe. And everything you thought was legitimate for Moshe before is still legitimate for him now. And therefore this story is put here to highlight, on the one hand, what people were thinking, on the other hand, the truth. But that only indicates, as we noted last week, that this is why it's the beginning of Moshe's leadership unraveling. Because even if it's illegitimate, as God himself says, for people to challenge Moshe's uniqueness, if even Miriam and Aaron are challenging his leadership at this point, it makes sense that there are going to be more challenges. It may be wrong. God may assert that it's wrong. But if even Miriam and Aaron can make the mistake, then you can't be surprised when you see it with the Meraglim, when you see it with Korach, when you see it, right? It makes sense. And therefore, this story is part of both the indication that Moshe's leadership is starting to weaken, even while simultaneously emphasizing that it shouldn't, still, that is the reality. Okay. To continue on this notion that this story is integrally connected with the previous story, so look at number 9. Rav Bazak notes that there is a chiasm in this story. I mean, we've discussed chiasms before, right? An ABBA structure. I mean, when you have a chiasm, it often draws your attention to what's in the middle. So he looks at the parsha and he says, look, there's actually a perfect chiasm here. The story starts off that Miriam spoke and Aaron against Moshe concerning the Kushite woman that he'd taken. The end of it, or the end of God's conversation, right? This is just a chiasm in the first few psukim, is Moshe and Aaron spoke, so at the end God says, why weren't you afraid to speak? Right? The second element is, they said, did not God speak only with Moshe? And God answers that question, that I did, but not so my servant Moshe. Moshe and all my house, he is trusted. I speak with him mouth to mouth, meaning their challenge, aren't we prophets, is responded to by God. You are prophets, but not the way Moshe is a prophet. The third thing they said was, did he not speak also with us, and God heard it? And the response is, if there's a prophet among you, I, the Lord, make myself known to him in a vision. I speak with him in a dream. And they say, did he speak with us? And God says, I do, but not the way I speak with him. Right? It's two parts of the prophecy. Did he speak only with us? Sorry, did he only speak with Moshe? Doesn't he speak with us? And he says, I speak with others differently, and therefore Moshe is unique. Right? So both of those elements are responded. And the middle is, right, hear my words. So then he continues. He said, the outermost branches address the first grievance raised by Moshe and Aaron, in which they speak against Moshe, Aaron and Miriam. Speak against Moshe. The next outermost branches deal with God's speech to Moshe, and the inner branches address God's speech to Aaron and Miriam. At the center is God's introductory phrase, hear now my words, listen to me, and see the matter as it really is. In this way, God connects the two complaints of Miriam and Aaron. They had maintained that they were on the same level as Moshe and could therefore permit themselves to speak against him. Had they understood that there was an essential difference between his level and their own, and that God spoke with him in a completely different manner, they would have feared to speak against him. Indeed, careful examination of the verses show that God says nothing at all on the subject of the Cushite wife, indicating that the complaint in this regard is not worthy of any response at all. Meaning it's not really about whether you think it's about the marriage or divorce. The real, again, whether you think it's like Rashi, that if a prophet has to be abstinent, why aren't we abstinent? It must be you don't need to. Whether you think it's like Shaddal, that whether you think it's like Ibn Kaspi, it doesn't matter. What he points out is that the psukim themselves emphasize that the real problem here wasn't their local complaint. It's that the reason either they felt entitled to speak about Moshe, or two, the reason they thought that Moshe shouldn't be different than them was because they misunderstood who he was. And that's the real issue. God doesn't even respond to the Isha Kushit question because that's not the story. As to the issue itself, it appears that the Torah sees nothing wrong with the fact that Moshe had married a Cushite wife. Right? That's really, right? God is fine with it. No one really cares. What's really the problem here is that they thought either they had the right to speak or knew what Moshe should be doing because they thought their prophecy was equal to his. From that perspective, it highlights why this is the continuation of the story of Eldad and Medad. Because what's really, as I said, what's really at stake is Moshe different than everybody else? Eldad and Medad's story call that into question. This story is coming to affirm, yes, Moshe is different, even though you don't realize it. And even though there are going to be more and more things that are going to make it that you don't realize it, he is unique. And that's what I gave you in 10 from Al HaTorah. They summarize it nicely, right? They say, this approach takes this story as an outgrowth of the preceding incident in which the 70 elders receive a share of Moshe's prophecy and leadership. Moshe's need for assistance in the sharing of prophecy paved the way to challenge both his capacity for leadership and the uniqueness of his prophetic status. According to this position, Miriam and Aaron's challenge of Moshe's authority is related not only to the story which immediately preceded it, and this is what's important, but also the narratives which follow it. The spies in the rebellion of Korach, they all share the common theme of rebellion against Moshe's leadership, right? So it's not just that this explains why it happens now, it explains the next stories. Again, if Moshe and Aaron can start challenging Moshe's leadership, then of course everyone else will, hence the Meraglim, hence Korach. So this, you know, is just on the continuum. Rav Meidan has a tweak on this position, which is that they're not worried about Moshe's leadership. What they're worried about is succession. Is that once Moshe starts delegating, it's clear that Moshe is looking towards the next generation. And then what does he do? He marries a second wife. So what do they panic? Oh, is his plan to father a new child from this Cushite woman who's going to be part of his succession plan, right? Moshe is clearly moving out of the leadership light. He's getting other leaders. Is this part of his plan? And Miriam and Aaron panic because they think, oh, he's not only setting up bureaucracy, he's marrying a new wife to have a new child to take over. And that's why they panic, because they don't want that to happen. Now, that's another twist on the, this is part of the story of Moshe's leadership starting to, right, unravel, of everyone recognizing that they're entering a new stage in life, and that's what creates the creates the tension. Okay, now the humility point. Okay, so we've read some of the explanations of why the humility point is here. Just to go over it, though, right? So Meshach, they didn't care about the challenge to his honor, and that's why God needs to stand up to it. Stand up for him, right? That's simple. But Michal Sperber has an article where she argues that maybe Anav Ma'od is not a compliment. I mean, it is, but it's not a full compliment. It's a compliment with a modicum of critique, which is, Moshe, you're humble, that's great. But you really got to stand up for yourself, because otherwise, these challenges to your leadership are going to get worse. Because you see, in the last story, Yeshua stood up for Moshe, and Moshe said, eh, now that may be good. And here, Miriam and Aaron challenge his leadership, and Moshe says, eh, but God stands up for him. Because God recognizes it's very nice to be humble, but if you never stand up for yourself, then, you know, the small hole in the dam becomes a flood. And even though you may not care, so, okay, with Eldad and Medad, that was nice. With Miriam and Aaron, it's nice. But I can't let Miriam get away with it, because if I let Miriam get away with it, it's going to get worse. And even though I didn't let Miriam get away with it, it got worse. So she suggests that maybe the humility thing is being brought here not only as a compliment to emphasize that Moshe is great and doesn't care, but to remind you that, you know what, there is a cost to not recognizing who you are, because if you don't recognize who you are, then people will build on that. And that explains the next few stories, because Moshe consistently doesn't stand up for himself, so then the challenges are going to continue. And that's why the Meraglim, right, he's falling on his face. And again, Yehoshua and Kalev have to stand up for him, right? Each of the next stories is a story of, you know, Moshe not standing up for himself until Korach, when Moshe does stand up for himself, and that's an utter disaster, right? But you see, right, Moshe, it's like even Moshe, and when we get to it, we'll see why is it that Moshe doesn't stand up for himself in Eldad and Medad, he doesn't stand up for himself in the Miriam story, he doesn't stand up for himself in the Meraglim, right? In the Meraglim, he stands up for the Jews, he doesn't stand up for himself, though, right? Kalev does, right? And as Rashi highlights, really, the Kalev stands up for him. But in Korach, he stands up for himself in a way that he never has, and that's going to be a big question, why is he doing that? But that's, you know, we'll get to it. In Allah Torah, they summarize a few different positions, and they write as follows. Moshe and Avmo. The exegetes offer several explanations to why the Torah chose to emphasize Moshe's modesty at this juncture. So one, explaining God's intervention. According to Targum Pseudo-Jonathan and Rehearsed, the statement is clarifying that Moshe himself was not bothered by his siblings' criticism, since he would never defend himself, Hashem intervened on his behalf. Or clarifying the complaint. Abarbanel asserts, this statement is not a parenthetical comment made by the text, but is rather a rhetorical question posed by Miriam and Aaron. This is fascinating. He says that It's not a statement. It's them asking, is he the humblest person ever? And God says, yes, he is. Right? Meaning, the reason, you know, Miriam and Aaron are like, is he really that humble? And the answer is, oh, yes, he is. That's why, right? He doesn't stand up for things. That's why. They raise and reject the possibility that as Moshe is extremely humility, they led him to abstain from relations. Defense of Moshe, or first suggests that the statement proves that Moshe's actions could not have been motivated by any feelings of pride or gloating, or defense of Miriam and Aaron. This is the most interesting, is that Hirsch, and this comes back to Michal Sperber's point. I don't know. She was on the VBM. I don't know who she is. But it's interesting. It's a two-page article. I don't know who she is. But it was an interesting article. He says, actually, defense of Miriam and Aaron. Namely, Moshe never stood up for himself. That's why they didn't know how great he was. I mean, and this goes back to her point that on the one hand, it defends Moshe, but it also simultaneously defends Miriam and Aaron, because if he never says, "Hi, I'm the greatest prophet ever," how are they supposed to know? Right? From their vantage point, the Torah is telling you, you know why Miriam and Aaron were ready to challenge Moshe's leadership and they thought that he was just like them? Because Moshe never said otherwise. How are they supposed to know? And God has to say, yeah, he's really humble, so he never said it, but let me tell you. But that means that there was a lack of information, which Moshe, it may be great that he's humble, but again, descriptively, that means they didn't know how great he was. I would suggest that maybe what this is doing is saying that is that the Torah puts that line here to remind us that even though Moshe's leadership is facing challenges, that doesn't mean he isn't great. All right, this story, if nothing else, highlights simultaneously that his leadership is being challenged, but that he really is still Moshe Rabbeinu, right? Which is something that you need to be reminded of in the middle of four consecutive stories of Moshe's leadership being challenged, right? Is that Moshe is still Moshe. And God coming out and saying, yeah, Moshe is the greatest person ever, is a nice reminder that even the greatest person ever can have problems. Don't think that he's facing problems. I mean, Nechama Leibovitz really points to Rabbeinu Bachya for this as follows, right? Rabbeinu Bachya writes as follows, that in the context of his, you know, just ethical discussions, he writes, if one of your peers is greater than you in some aspect of the service of God and is actually greater than yours, and he tries harder than you to come close to God, the Yetzer will incite you against him and say, any zeal by your peers in the service of God highlights your own deficiencies. Because if it were not for this man, you in the eyes of men and God, the most righteous of your generation, denigrate him, envy him, hate him, seek out his faults, wait for his transgressions, watch for his mistakes, and publicize them as much as you can, and belittle him for them. If you can spread false rumors about him to lower his esteem in the eyes of the public, do it. They then answer him, how could I be repulsed by someone who loves God and denigrate one who the Creator deems praiseworthy? Is it not enough that I'm lazy and not doing the service of God as zealously as him, that I must also hate one who serves God? This is certainly no way to repay the Creator for what I owe him. Rather, it is my duty out of the love of God to love those who love him, and out of honor of God to honor those who honor him, as written, and he honors those who God honored. No, honor God, rather. And you already know what happened to Miriam, as written, Miriam and Aaron spoke against Moshe, and what happened to Korach and his followers in envying Moshe and Aaron due to their closeness of God. Now, shockingly, Rabbeinu Bachya seems to say that this is a story of...
jealousy.
Yeah, that Miriam and Aaron are just jealous, like Korach. Right? That's what he says. I didn't say it, Rabbeinu Bachya said it. Right? That this story is saying that Miriam and Aaron are jealous, just like Korach is jealous. And so why is the story here, as Nechama Leibovitz says, to contrast, that Moshe, not only is he not jealous, he says to Yoshua, let everyone be Nevi'im. So this is sort of where I would suggest that maybe this story isn't here to highlight Moshe's weakening leadership, but to highlight why, despite it all, he's great. That even though even Miriam and Aaron are jealous of him, right, and Korach's jealous of him, and whatever, Moshe... despite it all, remains Moshe. Anav mikol adam, who wants everybody else to have prophecy, and his leadership may be failing, but Moshe is Moshe. Moshe cares about people. So this story simultaneously highlights the reality that Moshe's leadership is starting to face challenges, but also the reality that that doesn't diminish the fact that Moshe is great, except maybe, as Michal Sperber notes and Reversh notes, that it does explain... that, you know, the extent to which his humility was did have a cost and sort of helped the, you know, the dam open up a little bit more. So it's a simultaneous explanation of why his leadership faced problems while emphasizing how great he is. Two last points. Because I'd already made the point about the Rav Bazak's point about the celibacy, whether this story is celebrating it or denigrating it. Two last points. First, just a point from Rav Samet, which is just beautiful, before I get to 15, is that the Mida Keneged Mida punishment in the story is beautiful. Because whatever, however you understand the Isha Kushit, it's clear that the image is something about marrying the woman with the dark skin is negative. Right? Whatever, however you understand it. The punishment is that Miriam becomes white as snow, but that's negative, right? So the message, at some level, is clearly it's not about the color of your skin, right? It's about your actions, right? It doesn't matter, right? You criticized him for marrying the Isha Kushit, right? You are now going to be, right, as white as snow, and that's going to be the negative, because his Isha Kushit is a positive, and your Mitzarat Keshelik is a negative, right? There's a clear, sort of, very, you know, vivid imagery there that is critiquing Miriam in a real way, right? It's not about color of skin, it's about, are you right or wrong, right? That's, I think that is, like, a... It's just clear that that is part of it. The last question is there any resolution in the story, right? Meaning, is this story, as we said, just another story in the unraveling of Moshe's leadership? Is it the unraveling of Moshe's leadership simultaneously emphasizing how great he is, or is there actually a certain level of resolution in this story? So if you look at Rav Simon 15, he suggests, he said, now let us turn to this triangular relationship in section B, second half. Miriam, who spoke about her brother, is now silent. Perhaps because the Nativ explains in verse 10, she was astounded and dumbfounded from sorrow. Aaron, who was Moshe's partner in speaking against Moshe, now turns to Moshe and represents his sister too in requesting of Moshe, do not hold our sin against us, and requesting that he heal Miriam. Moshe, the humble, silent one, now cries out to God, asking that he heal Miriam. The one who was spoken about now cries out without any grudge or any accounting, thereby revealing his humility and his trait of returning evil with kindness. This change of status in the sibling triangle demonstrates the positive effect of the punishment on Aaron and Miriam's perception of their brother Moshe. He notes that this is not clearly a negative story. Right? It does provide, it's not a pure downhill. There, it's clear, it may be a function of Moshe's weakening leadership and their challenges to leadership, but it's clear that at least Miriam and Aaron learned their lesson. Right, the story is as much about the fact that Miriam and Aaron challenge his leadership, that is, that they then learn their lesson, and that Moshe forgives them, and that Aaron recognizes Moshe's status and therefore turns to him for help. So it is, while maybe not pure resolution, because it's clear that Moshe's leadership continues to face challenges in the next stories, that it is, does at some level indicate that it's not a downhill battle. If people had realized who Moshe was, like Miriam and Aaron, they could have stemmed the tide. And Miriam and Aaron themselves end up, right, they made a temporary mistake, but they learned their lesson. In the Meraglim story, you see that most of them make mistakes, but there's a holdout. Yeshua and Kalev don't, right? Meaning, this story emphasizes that it's not impossible. That even as Moshe's leadership is facing problems, it's not impossible there will be people who understand the truth. Miriam and Aaron learned their lesson. Yeshua and Kalev continue to learn the lesson in the story of the Meraglim. So this story, again, I think is placed here because it's part of the story of Moshe's leadership weakening, but it also emphasizes at the same time that you can, if you pay attention to God, stem that tide and correct their mistake. And two, it highlights... Even while highlighting Moshe's weakening, it simultaneously reminds us that he was that great, so that you have a balanced approach to the complexity in the stories that follow. Okay, so that is...